So the other day, I was on the long train reading a little bit of Bolaño, and it occurred to me that long trains should be the required reading environment for Bolaño, just as one shouldn't be far from a sun-roofed car while setting off on a trip with Bernhard, or one should absolutely be stranded in the middle of the forest before taking a turn with Thomas Mann. And for a while, I thought about listing out all my perfect inseparable book environment pairings, because I seem to be an expert at this, and turning it into, you know, the written law. But then I realized that that might appear a little, if not elitist, then maybe fascist, so far as these things go anyway. So I'll let it to you to close your eyes and imagine yourself on the train, or on the grass at the park, or in the fourth row of the airplane, or wherever, in the interest of good, hearty social liberalism, or whatever. So good evening. It's Wednesday, the 25th of April, is it really? And it's Miette's Bedtime Story Podcast. A Literary Adventure by Roberto Bolaño. B writes a book in which he makes fun of certain writers, variously disguised, or, to be more precise, certain types of writers. In one of his stories, there is a character not unlike A, a writer of about B's age, but who, unlike B, is famous, well-off, and has a large readership. In other words, he has achieved the three highest goals in that order to which a man of letters can aspire. B is not famous. He has no money, and his poems are published in little magazines. Yet A and B are not entirely dissimilar. They both come from lower middle class or upwardly mobile working class families. Politically, both are left-wing. They have in common a keen intellectual curiosity and a deficient formal education. With A's meteoric rise, however, a sanctimonious tone has crept into his writing, and B, who is a slave to print, finds this particularly irritating. In his newspaper articles, and with increasing frequency in his books, A has taken to pontificating on all things great and small, human or divine, with a leaden pedantry, like a man who, having used literature as a ladder to social status and respectability, and now ensconced in his nouveau riche ivory tower, snipes at anything that might tarnish the mirror in which he contemplates himself and the world. For B, in short, A has become a prig. B, as I said, writes a book, and in one of the chapters he makes fun of A. The portrait is not especially cruel, and it is confined to one chapter of a sizable volume. He creates a character, Alvaro Medina Mina, a successful writer who happens to express the same opinions as A. The contexts are transposed. Where A rails against pornography, Medina Mina attacks violence. Where A criticizes the commercialism of contemporary art, Medina Mina marshals his arguments against pornography. The story of Medina Mina doesn't stand out from others in the book, most of which are better in terms of composition, though perhaps no better written. B's book is published. It is the first time he has been taken on by a major publishing house, and reviews begin to appear. Very slowly at first, then in one of the country's leading newspapers. A publishes a review, positively glowing with enthusiasm, which convinces the remaining critics and turns B's book into a minor bestseller. Naturally, B feels uncomfortable, initially at least. Then, as is often the way, it strikes him as natural, or at least logical, that A should praise his book. After all, it is an interesting book in various ways, and A is not a bad critic, after all. But 2 months later, in an interview published in another, less prestigious newspaper, A mentions B's book again, in extremely laudatory terms, wholeheartedly giving it his stamp of approval, an untarnished mirror. There is something about A's tone, however, that makes B wary, as if there were a message to be read between the lines, as if the famous writer were saying to him, "Don't think you've fooled me. I know you put me in your book. I know you made fun of me." "He's praising my book to the skies," thinks B, "so he can let it plummet back to earth later on. Or he's praising my book to make sure no one will identify him with Medina Mina. Or he hasn't even realized it was a case of genuine appreciation, a simple meeting of minds." None of these possibilities seems to bode well. B doesn't believe that minds can meet in a simple or innocent way, and he resolves to do all he can to meet A in person. Deep down he knows that A has recognized himself in Medina Mina. He is at least reasonably sure that A has read his book in its entirety with due attention. So why would he be talking about it like this? Why praise a book that makes fun of you? By now, B is beginning to think that the caricature was not only exaggerated, but also perhaps a little unfair. He can't figure it out. The only half-plausible explanation is that A hasn't, in fact, identified himself, which, given his advancing cretinism, might just be the case. B reads his articles systematically. He has read every one since the glowing review, and some mornings he longs to plant his fist in A's increasingly prudish face, oozing self-assurance and righteous anger, as if he thought he were the reincarnation of Unamuno or something. So, B does everything he can to meet A face to face, but does not succeed. They live in different cities. A travels a good deal, and B can't be sure of finding him at home. His telephone is almost always busy, or the answering machine is on, in which case B hangs up immediately because he is terrified of answering machines. After a while, B gives up the idea of contacting A. He tries to forget the whole business, and almost does. He writes another book. When it is published, the first review to appear is by A. So quickly does it appear, in fact, that B cannot even see how the quickest and most assiduous reader could have got through the book so soon. It was sent out to the critics on a Thursday, and A's review was published the following Saturday. It is long, at least 5 pages of typescript. Considered, and insightful, too, a lucid, illuminating reading, even for B, to whom it reveals aspects of the book that had escaped his notice. At first, B is grateful and flattered. Then he is frightened. It strikes him that A could not possibly have read the book between the day the publisher sent it out and the review's publication date. The way the mail works in Spain, if a book is sent out on Thursday, you'd be lucky to get it the following Monday. The first explanation that occurs to be is that A wrote the review without reading the book, but that is untenable. A has obviously read the book, and read it carefully. There is, however, a more credible explanation. A obtained the book directly from the publishing house. B phones the marketing manager. He asks how it is possible that A had already read his book. The marketing director has no idea, although he has read the review and is very pleased. He promises to look into it. B almost gets down on his knees, insofar as one can transmit such a posture via the telephone, and begs him to call back that night. Predictably enough, B spends the rest of the day coming up with increasingly absurd scenarios. At 9 that evening, after getting home, he calls the marketing director. There is, of course, a perfectly logical explanation. A happened to visit the publishing house some days before the copies were sent out. He took one with him, and so was able to read it at his leisure and write the review. Having heard this, B calms down. He tries to put a meal together, but there's nothing in the fridge, so he decides to go out for dinner. He takes along the newspaper with the review in it. At first, he walks aimlessly through the empty streets. Then he finds a little restaurant that he has never patronized and goes in. All the tables are empty. B sits down next to the window in a corner away from the fireplace, which is feebly warming the room. A girl asks him what he would like. B says he would like to have dinner. The girl is very pretty. Her hair is long and messy, as if she'd just got out of bed. B orders soup and a meat, and vegetable stew to follow. While he is waiting, he reads the review again. "I have to see A," he thinks. "I have to tell him I'm sorry. I should never have started this game." There is, however, absolutely nothing offensive about the review. The other reviewers will end up saying all the same things, though perhaps not as well. "A does know how to write," thinks B reluctantly, or perhaps resignedly. The food tastes like earth, decay, and blood. The chill in the restaurant is seeping into his bones. That night he has serious stomach trouble, and the next morning he staggers to the walk-in clinic of the nearest hospital. The doctor who sees him prescribes antibiotics and bland food for a week. Lying in bed and inclined to stay there, B decides to phone a friend. He needs to tell someone the whole story. But he can't decide whom to call. What if I telephoned A and told him, pretending it was all about someone else, he wonders. But no, at best A would think it was a coincidence. He would go back and read B's books in a different light, then tear him to shreds in public. At worst, A would pretend not to have understood him. In the end, B doesn't call anyone, and soon another kind of fear begins to grow in him. What if someone, some anonymous reader, has realized that Alvaro Medina Mina is A in disguise? The situation is already horrible. If someone else found out, he reflects, it could become intolerable. But who would be able to identify the model for Alvaro Medina Mina? In theory, any of the 3,500 readers of the novel's first edition. In practice, a handful of individuals, A's devoted fans, literary sleuths, or people like B who are exasperated by the rising tide of millennial moralizing and pontification. What can B do to keep the secret? He doesn't know. He runs through various possibilities, from enthusiastically reviewing A's next opus, or even writing a book-length study of his work to date, including the unfortunate newspaper articles, to calling up A and laying his cards, whatever they might be, on the table, or paying him a visit one night, cornering him in the entrance hall of his apartment, and forcing him to confess why he is doing this, why he has fastened on to B's work like a limpet, what kind of redress he is seeking in this roundabout way. In the end, B doesn't do anything. His new book is favourably reviewed but sells poorly. No one is surprised that A had endorsed it, except when he is judging Spanish letters and politics from his high horse, like Cato the Censor. A is reasonably generous in his treatment of newcomers to the literary scene. After a while, B forgets the whole business. Perhaps, he tells himself, it was all the figment of his feverish imagination, overexcited by having two books come out with major publishers. Perhaps it was a delusion spawned by his secret fears, or a symptom of nervous exhaustion after so many years of hard labour and obscurity. So he puts it out of his mind, and after a while the incident begins to fade, like any other memory, though perhaps it remains more vivid than most. Then one day he is invited to a conference on new writing to be held in Madrid. B is delighted to attend. He is about to finish another book, and the conference he thinks will serve as a platform for pre-publicity. The trip and the hotel have been paid for, of course, and B wants to take advantage of his time in the capital to visit galleries and relax. The conference will last 2 days. B is participating in the first day's proceedings, and will be a member of the audience on the second day. When it is all over, the writers are to be transported en masse to the residence of the Countess of Bahamontes, woman of letters and patron of various cultural programs and organizations, including a writer's fellowship bearing her name, and a poetry magazine, probably the best of those published in the capital. B, who knows no one in Madrid, joins the group, heading to the Countess's house, to finish off the evening. After a light but delicious supper, liberally washed down with vines from the family vineyards, the party continues into the small hours. At the start there are no more than 15 people present, but as the hours go by, the festivities are enlivened by the arrival of a variegated array of arts personalities, including several writers, but also filmmakers, actors, painters, television hosts, and bullfighters. At one point, B has the privilege of being introduced to the Countess and the honour of being taken aside by her and led to a corner of the terrace, where there is a view over the garden. "There's a friend waiting for you down there," says the smiling Countess, gesturing with her chin toward a wooden arbour surrounded by palms, pines, and plane trees. B looks at her uncomprehendingly. Once, he thinks, long ago, she must have been pretty, but now she is a jumble of flesh and twitchy sinews. B doesn't dare ask who the friend is. He nods, assures her he will go down immediately, but doesn't move. The Countess doesn't move either, and for a moment they both stand there in silence, looking into each other's eyes as if they had known each other, or loved and hated each other, in another life. Then other guests come and dear the Countess, and B is left alone, fearfully gazing at the garden and the arbour in which, after a while, he is sure he can see someone, or the fleeting moment of a shadow. "It must be A," he thinks, from which he immediately deduces, "he must be armed." B's first thought is to flee, but then he realizes that the only way out, as far as he knows, is past the arbour, so the best escape plan would be to stay in one of the mansion's innumerable rooms and wait for dawn. But maybe it's not A, thinks B. Maybe it's the editor of some magazine, or a publisher, or a writer who would like to meet me. Barely conscious of what he is doing, B withdraws from the terrace, picks up a drink and goes down the stairs and out into the garden. There he lights a cigarette and approaches the arbour, taking his time. When he gets there, he finds it empty, but he is sure he saw someone, so he decides to wait. An hour later, bored and tired, he returns to the house. He asks the few remaining guests, who are wandering about like sleepwalkers or actors in a terribly slow play, where the Countess is, but none of them can give him a coherent answer. A waiter, who could just as well have been a guest, tells him that the lady of the house has no doubt retired for the night, as it is past her bedtime. You know what old people like. B nods and thinks, fair enough, At her age, she can't afford to overdo things. Then he nods goodbye to the waiter. They shake hands, and he walks back to his hotel. It takes him more than 2 hours to get there. The next day, instead of catching his flight back to the city where he lives, B spends the morning moving to a cheaper hotel and settling in, as if he intends to spend a long time in the capital, and then devotes the whole afternoon to dialing A's home number. At first, he keeps getting the answering machine. A's voice and the voice of a woman, saying one after another, in cheerful tones, that they aren't in, but will be back soon, so leave a message, and if it's important, leave a number, so that they can call back. By the time he has listened to this invitation several times, without leaving a message, B has formed some hypotheses about A and his partner, and the mysterious entity they constitute. First, the woman's voice. She is young, much younger than A and B, energetic by the sound of it, determined to carve out her place in A's life and make sure that place is respected. Poor fool, thinks B. Then A's voice, supremely serene, the voice of Cato. This guy is a year younger than me, thinks B, but he sounds 15 or 20 years older. Finally, the message. Why the joyful tone? Why do they suppose that if it's important, the caller is going to stop trying and be content to leave his or her number? Why do they take turns as if they were reading out a play? To make it clear that two people live there, or to show the world what a wonderful couple they make? All these questions remain unanswered, of course, but B keeps calling, roughly once every half hour, and finally, at 10 that night, trying from a payphone in a cheap restaurant, he gets through, and a woman's voice answers. B is so surprised that at first he doesn't know what to say. "Who is it?" asks the woman. She asks several times, then remains silent, without hanging up, as if she was giving B time to gather his courage and speak. Then, slowly and thoughtfully, so he imagines, the woman hangs up. Half an hour later, B calls again from a telephone booth. Again it is the woman who picks up the phone, again asks who it is and waits for an answer. "I want to see A," says B. He should have said, "I want to speak with A," or at least that is what the woman assumes he meant, and she says so. After a moment of silence, B says, "Sorry, but what he wants is to see A." "And who, may I say, is calling?" "It's B," says B. The woman hesitates for a few seconds, as if she were wondering who B is, then says, "All right, hold on for a moment." Her tone of voice hasn't changed, thinks B, not the slightest hint of fear or aggression. B can hear voices. She must have left the receiver on a table or a chair or hanging from the wall in the kitchen. Although what they are saying is completely unintelligible, he can distinguish the voices of a man and a woman. A and his young partner, thinks B. But then a third voice joins in, a man's voice, much deeper. At first, it seems they are engaged in a conversation of such riveting interest that A cannot tear himself away from it, even for a moment. Then B thinks it sounds more like they are arguing, or trying to reach some agreement on an urgent question that must be settled before A can pick up the phone. And in this suspense or uncertainty, someone shouts, "Maybe A." Suddenly there is silence on the line, as if the woman had sealed B's ears with wax. And then, several 5 peseta coins later, quietly, gently, someone hangs up. B doesn't sleep that night. He plans to call again, but, impelled by superstition, decides to change booths. The next 2 phones he tries are out of order. Surprising how run down and dirty the capital is. and when he finally finds one that is working and goes to put the coins in the slot, his hands start shaking as if he were having some kind of attack. The sight of his shaking hands distresses him so much he almost bursts into tears. The best thing to do, he says sensibly, would be to calm down and collect himself, and for that, what better place than a bar? So he starts walking, and after a while, having rejected several bars for various and sometimes contradictory reasons, he enters a small establishment with excessively bright lighting, into which more than 30 people are packed. The atmosphere, as he promptly realizes, is one of unrestrained and noisy camaraderie. He soon finds himself talking to perfect strangers, who, in normal circumstances, back home in his day-to-day life, he would avoid. They are celebrating someone's last night as a bachelor, or the victory of a local soccer team. He returns to his hotel at dawn, feeling vaguely ashamed and cursing himself for not having persisted with the calls. The next day, instead of looking for somewhere to eat, he is not particularly surprised to discover that his appetite has disappeared. B goes into the first phone booth he can find, in a fairly noisy street, and calls A. Once again, the woman answers. He doesn't expect her to recognize him straight away, but she does. "A's not in," says the woman, "but he wants to see you." And after a silence, "We're very sorry about what happened yesterday." "What happened yesterday?" asks B, in all sincerity. "We kept you waiting, and then we hung up. I mean, I hung up. A wanted to talk to you, but I didn't think it was a good time." "Why not?" asks B, who has now cast aside all semblance of discretion. "For a number of reasons," says the woman. "A hasn't been well lately. When he talks on the phone, he tends to get overexcited. He was working, and I don't like to interrupt him." She doesn't sound as young as she did before. She is definitely not telling the truth, and not even taking the trouble to come up with convincing lies, plus which she hasn't even mentioned the man with the deep voice. But in spite of all this, Bea is charmed. She's lying, like a spoiled little girl, secure in the knowledge that I will forgive her lies, he thinks. And the way she is protecting A makes her all the more irresistible. "How long are you going to be in the city?" asks the woman. "Just until I see A, then I'll go," says B. "Uh-huh," says the woman, sending a shiver down B's spine. Then she thinks for a while in silence. During these seconds or minutes, B imagines her face. The image is vague but haunting. "The best thing would be for you to come tonight," says the woman. "Do you have the address?" "Yes," says B. "Good. We'll expect you for dinner at 8. "All right," says B in a faltering voice and hangs up. B spends the rest of the day wandering around like a vagabond or a lunatic. He doesn't visit a single gallery, of course, although he does go into a couple of bookshops in which he buys A's latest book. He finds a spot in a park and sits down to read it. The book is fascinating, although every page is steeped in sadness. "He is such a good writer," thinks B. He considers his own work, blemished by satire and rage, and compares it unfavorably to A's. Then he falls asleep in the sun, and when he wakes up, the park is full of beggars and junkies who seem, at first glance, to be moving around, but are not, in fact, although to say they are still would also be inaccurate. B goes back to his hotel, takes a shower, shaves, puts on his cleanest set of clothes, the ones he wore on his first day in Madrid, and sets off. A lives in the centre of the city, in an old 5-storey building. B presses the intercom button, and a woman's voice asks who it is. "It's B," says B. "Come in," says the woman, and the buzzing noise that is the security door when it is unlocked continues until B reaches the elevator. B even thinks he can hear it as he goes up to A's apartment, as if the elevator were dragging a long tail like that of a lizard or a snake. A is waiting for him on the landing, by the open door. He is tall, pale, and slightly fatter than in the photos. There is a certain shyness in his smile. For a moment, B feels as if the energy that brought him to A's door has suddenly drained away. He pulls himself together, tries to smile, holds out his hand. If I can just get through this without violence or melodrama, he thinks. At last, says A, how are you? Very well, says B.